Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, June 26, 2015, the Federal News Countdown, featuring the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are Sean Kingsbury, Director of Cloud Solutions at Engility, and a former Chief Information Officer at the RAT Board. It is great to see you, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Your first time on the Federal News Countdown.
Awesome. Excited to be here.
I'm very glad that you're here. And Mike Hettinger's here. He's Managing Principal at Hettinger Strategy Group. And Mike, it's terrific to see you as always. Just in from the golf course. You hit him okay today?
I hit him okay, but thanks for having me. I rushed over here as quick as I could. I'm glad to be here on a Friday afternoon.
I'm very happy to have you here. And you don't know it, Mike, but we have a world-renowned recording artist on the program today.
I'd heard something about it, but I haven't. I don't know all the details, so look forward to hearing about that as well.
In addition to being an information technology expert in the government space, Sean is also a recording artist in the genre of jazz and chill music. And how many albums do you have out now?
16.
16?
16?
I knew
wow.
It was a bunch, but I didn't know it was 16 albums. And I've got some of your stuff from iTunes. So, I mean, you're like, this is a real thing. And I will say to you today the same thing that I say to you every time you're on a panel or something that I moderate. Where's your CDs? You've got two customers in the room here, and you didn't bring anything along.
Well, he knows I have all his stuff on
okay, right.
I'll bring a briefcase next time.
That's what I've been telling you for years now, my friend.
That's right.
It's terrific that you're here. I'm happy to have both of you here, and we'll start where we always do with
number three.
And Mike, your choice is the third most important federal news story of the week from the Hill newspaper, and the headline is GOP reinstates punished lawmaker. Mark Meadows was chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Government Operations Subcommittee. Then he wasn't, and now he is again. And you have experience firsthand with this subcommittee, don't you?
I do. I was the staff director of this subcommittee, configured a little bit differently from 2003. To 2007. So I do know firsthand the important work that the subcommittee does. I have not worked personally with Chairman Meadows, but I have worked closely with his staff in the last 6-7 months since he's been chairman of the subcommittee. So, I mean, to me, this has been a interesting story. I was obviously sad to hear earlier in the week that he was going to be removed from his chairmanship. And then when he was reinstated, obviously, I think a lot of people in the community felt that was positive. He's really gotten down into the weeds of the subcommittee, which is important. This is a subcommittee that looks at, financial management issues and real hardcore government operations stuff. So to have somebody that's interested, willing to commit, willing to learn, willing to understand what shared services means, engage on IT issues, I think it's important to have somebody in there that's willing to really engage on those things. So, obviously this is a big story. You'll remember the original story I sent as my number three story was that he had been pulled off the subcommittee. So mm-hmm. I was glad yesterday afternoon to switch it up and have him reinstated.
So one of the things that I think is important to keep in mind here, I've gotten the same takeaway from Chairman Meadows that you have, that he's sincere about wanting to improve the operations of the government. He has spoken at hearings and so on about poor performers, but he also is coming at the federal workforce from the perspective of, I assume that almost all of you are good and doing the right thing and trying to serve the citizen, not you're bad. And that's rare in the Republican caucus right now. Your old boss, Todd Platts, did the same thing. But with him doing this, I saw that, as you did, as a potential tremendous loss if he was no longer the chairman. So I think it's good for federal employees that he's back on that.
Yeah, committee. No, I think that's right. I mean, anyone who can sort of look at it and say, I recognize that most federal employees are there to do the right thing, I think is a positive. And as you said, I mean, it's all too easy oftentimes to just beat up on federal employees, but to have somebody in there that seems to care, that's made an effort to understand what they do and why it's important. I agree. It's a good positive sign that he's still in there.
Mike Hettinger's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week from the Hill newspaper. GOP reinstates punished lawmaker. Sean Kingsbury, your choice at number three is a commentary from Van Hitch, the former Justice Department CIO, writing in the Fed Times. The headline is OMB FATARA guidance offers opportunity for CIOs. Van knows of what he speaks, so when he looks at something like this, it commands a lot of attention.
So So, you know, I read this article and I actually thought back on my days of being a CTO and CIO. And this is a huge opportunity for federal to actually have the CIO have a seat at the table for agency-wide business decisions. Because, you know, when you look in across the past, right, it was more or less the CIO was focused on ensuring mail was up and running, desktops and those types of things. But now it's a real seat to understand how things get done and is empowered, right? Meaning they're actually empowered with by policy and guidance. And it's going to definitely make a difference there. There are going to be some challenges, but it's nothing happens overnight, mm-hmm. right? So it's got to be a lot of coordination with a sub bureau level CIOs to ensure that you know everyone's going down the same path. But it's definitely an opportunity to make a change and make difference.
Van writes, "What should CIOs do first?" is a question he gets on an ongoing basis. He writes, "I suggest focusing on two things. First, shift your thinking, and you and I have talked about that one before. And the second is to develop an overall strategy to guide IT activities and capabilities across the entire department." What it sounds like he's saying there, I'm reading between the lines, and Van, if you're listening, I apologize if I'm putting words in your mouth. But what it sounds like he's saying there is become the executive that you want to be vis-a-vis being welcomed at the table.
That's right. Well, it all starts with the strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, you can't just look at policy and execute based on that.
Yep.
You have to say, now, what does this mean to me or what does it mean to us? And then develop a strategy for implementation.
And that takeaway is something that I've heard reinforced by other CIOs, not just recently regarding Fitara, but historically as this conversation about what is the role of the chief information officer has evolved. And that is, don't wait necessarily for somebody to say, hey, come on into the CIO suite and you're part of this conversation. And okay, so now what do you think? Show them what's going on and show them why you should be there. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that you didn't portray it this way. You're much too humble. But that's the way that you presented it to me about what you did at the RAT board. Here's what the IT strategy of the agency should be, in my view, and that earns CIOs that place at the table.
And actually, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up. I mean, at the recovery board, that's the way we worked, right? The CIO was at the table with the chair, mm-hmm. with mission support, with all of the key decision makers. And collectively, we had a strategy and we had to deliver services and meet our legal requirements.
Sean Kingsbury's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is from Fed Times. It's Van Hitch's column there, headlined OMB Fitara Guidance Offers Opportunity for CIOs. All the choices on this week's Federal News Countdown archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And when we come back, the second most important stories of the week is selected by Sean Kingsbury and Mike Hettinger. It's the Federal News Countdown. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Mike Hettinger and Sean Kingsbury, and we're up to
number two.
And Sean, your choice at number two is from GCN. The headline is, After FedRAMP, Trust But Verify. And FedRAMP seal of approval isn't enough to secure a system, according to Matt Goodrich, who runs the FedRAMP program now at GSA. Where I think that he's correct, obviously, he knows what he's talking about. But where I think the confusion has come from is a perception that GSA tried to get in front of from the very beginning, and I'm not sure that people heard the message very well, is that FedRAMP was always intended, the way Dave McClure explained it to me, as a ceiling, or excuse me, I'm getting it wrong now, as a floor mm-hmm. and not a ceiling. It was not supposed to be that you could just do FedRAMP, you buy something FedRAMP compliant, and that was the end of it. You could use that with a level of confidence and then decide how much more you required the system to security you required the system or the vendor to be able to produce. Do I understand it correctly?
Yes, you do. So security is a responsibility of everybody, right? It's not just, you know, you can, it's not a, okay, this company is FedRAMP certified, so I am good.
Mm-hmm.
No, you have to do your due diligence, and you have to look at leveraging a lot of the zone-based security architectures that are in play today. And it's people, process, and technology too. So it's not just I have this FedRAMP stamp on it, right? And now this stamp is going to protect me. I have to put together my continuous monitoring. I have to put together, you know, how do I secure things from a zone-based security perspective. But something else I think is really important. When the importance of FedRAMP is actually at another level, right? When you look at the allocation for 2016, is $7.3 billion in cloud. Right. And then when you look at the overarching budget, it's $86 billion. So 10% of federal spend is going to be in 2016. It's going to be on cloud solutions. So now when you come back to FedRAMP, you say this is critical. Right. So now it's more or less now you have this view of one, I need to be able to leverage it. Two, we have to get more cloud certified providers through this process as well. And three, we have to be able to work as a partnership to ensure the security of our information.
And this is, Sean's numbers are dead on, but another thing to consider is that the 90% that's not cloud per se relies on cloud infrastructure. I imagine there's a lot of spend that goes in that way, or interacts somehow with the applications that are moved to the cloud.
Sure.
So it's not just the 10% that Sean's talking about, although he's exactly right.
No, and I mean, we're moving in that direction, obviously, and the challenge has always been with FedRAMP since they introduced it 3.5-4 years ago is getting the companies through the process, and that continues to be a challenge. I tell people all the time, Francis, that I get more phone calls from people at companies who have questions about FedRAMP. How can you help me work through the FedRAMP program? How can you help me get in front of Matt Goodrich and the team? You know, there's things in the process that just aren't working for us, and so I'm part of a couple different groups that are trying to help move this along. But you're right. At the end of the day, we're moving in this direction, and to me, FedRAMP needs to speed up a little bit so it can keep pace with the fact that we're going to be spending 10% of the budget in 2016 on cloud solutions, and there's probably another 20% or so that's wrapped around that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I mean, just to build on to that, I mean, there's this requirement to do a better job of educating, right? Because that's part of the slow up as well, is industry and federal understanding what it really means and how you leverage it and how you get into the process and get through it, because there's that confusion and different perspectives of what it means causes delays.
Mm-hmm. Is that happening, do you think, because of the process that is established for people to go through, or because of maybe a lack of readiness of the vendors to go through that process, or maybe some of both?
I was about to say all of the above.
Yeah.
It's definitely both.
Yeah. The second most important federal news story of the week from Sean Kingsbury is after FedRAMP, trust but verify. That's from GCN. Mike Hettinger, your choice at number two is from U.S. News and World Report. The headline is Senate confirms new TSA administrator following reports of security gaps at airports. The vice commandant of the Coast Guard, Peter Neffinger, is the new TSA administrator. And it strikes me that this is a case not just of this person being a great fit for the agency, as it appears everybody believes he is, but also of new leadership being a breath of fresh air for the infrastructure of the agency and for all the employees down
line. I mean, that's really why I picked it as my number two story this week. I mean, first of all, we've been without a TSA administrator confirmed since, I guess, mid-December. So having someone in there with the responsibility, I think, is important. You couple that with the fact that the previous administrator had a you know, fairly turbulent 4.5 years in the post. And then you have just recently these reports coming out of security breaches, able to get, banned weapons and other things through security at an overwhelming rate, like 95% mm-hmm. of the things they tried to get through, they were able to get through.
67 out of 70.
Yeah. I don't know what that equates to in numbers, but that's a lot. Right?
Really bad is what
really
I think
bad
that
is
equates
right.
to.
And so I think to have somebody in there, Senate confirmed with the authority, with the support, overwhelmingly approved by the Senate to get in there. To me, that's huge, and you hope that he'll be able to get in there and knock some heads, quite honestly, and get things back on the right track at TSA.
I note, too, that as you mentioned, he was approved, confirmed overwhelmingly, 81-1, Sean. And this story says, casting a lone vote against the nominee was Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who said in a statement, while Neffinger is impressive, it's naive and dangerous to pretend installing one director can heal what ails TSA. I understand where he's coming from. And, you know, it's his prerogative as a senator to make a protest vote if that's what he feels like. But to be fair to the vice commandant of the Coast Guard, who's now TSA administrator, I mean, he essentially got in unanimously, because it sounds like that Senator Sasse doesn't have anything against him. It's just the situation the agency's in.
I mean, the I guess the point that he raises is, okay, you know, there's no silver bullet.
Yep.
And when you have unanimously being confirmed in, it makes sense. And you got to have a person in this role because it's key, especially when you look at all the challenges that we've been having from a TSA perspective.
And it's a numbers issue. 60,000 employees at TSA. TSA runs security operations at more than 450 airports. And the problems that you alluded to, Mike, revealed earlier this month, auditors were able to sneak prohibited items through TSA security checkpoints 67 out of 70 tries. Another report disclosed 73 airport workers with unspecified ties to terrorism were allowed to work in secure areas. So he does have his work cut out for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
No question
about
it. The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Mike Hettinger, is from U.S. News & World Report. It's the AP story headlined, Senate confirms new TSA administrator following reports of security gaps at U.S. airports. You can find that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Mike Hettinger and Sean Kingsbury on this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Mike Hettinger and Sean Kingsbury. And we are up to
number one.
And Sean, your most important federal news story of the week is the deadline that is upcoming for agencies to put together their digital services team. Every agency will have one, and they're standing them up now. And the conversation primarily that I see revolving around the digital services teams is, what's the breakdown between agency people and non-agency people? I had Jennifer Tress from 18F on the program last week, and she made it very clear that we're looking for talent that's already inside the federal government to come and work with us at 18F. So she wanted to make sure that people didn't think that, oh, we're only trying to recruit people from Silicon Valley and nobody in the government's qualified and capable of doing this. I think that's an important message to send. But boy, we are sure seeing a different worldview that's coming from the people who are coming from the Valley and coming from Austin and coming from Boston and other IT hotbeds around the country, aren't we?
So it is a challenge, right? When you look at digital services and, well, first off, I think this is important.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to see that there is a focus on digital services and there's a connection between digital services and FATAR when
yep.
you look at what this means, right? But this focus on digital services and creating this group, right? The initial challenges was, okay, so where am I going to get all these new people, right? So that's interesting, but then it turned into I can reach across my agency to bring people into these roles. You still have a challenge that, it's hard to find good people to actually meet to deliver these types of services. The other challenge there is we can't think that just creating a technical group from a digital services group is going to be the silver bullet
mm-hmm.
because you have to business drives technology. Technology enables business to meet its goals and objectives. So you have to have people embedded in this that can transform business requirements into technological solutions. Now, the outcome of this will be great because now you have a group that's in the beginning of the process, throughout the process, and as you get into implementation, which should result in better statements of work from a requirement standpoint and better partnership in implementation between with industry. interesting thing is that is the way the board was actually structured, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning the board, from my perspective, was one of the first digital services groups, right? Where we had a team of people brought in to meet requirements, and the mission was really based on digital services.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had smart, highly qualified people to build, develop, implement, and be a good partner to industry.
And you had the advantage of starting from scratch. So you didn't have a bunch of legacy you had to cut through. Not every agency has that benefit. But where I think the proof will really be in the pudding with this, Mike, is we were talking during the break about some of the dollars that are involved here, because that's really where it all happens in Washington,
right?
Is you see what really is going to happen by where the money goes. And we can maybe use that to get a clue of whether this concept is going to stick around after January 20th, 2017. That's the other embedding that I think we'll be paying attention to.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, we're taking this model now, and digital services are going out away from GSA and USDS and 18F and into the agencies,
mm-hmm.
and they need to be funded in those agencies. And from some of the work that I've done, there are challenges there. Some of the appropriation bills have reduced funding for the digital services teams. I think some have actually maybe eliminated funding for them completely within certain agencies. And I obviously don't have the details with me today, but it's going to be an ongoing battle. I think there's a lot happening. And at the end of the day, in order for this to really be successful, it's going to need to be funded across the government, not just at the USDS 18F GSA level. And so we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, there's a connection between this digital services initiative and the TSA issue. When
yep.
you look at, you know, let's say risk, right? Being able to identify risk and be able to, you know, proactively act on it before it becomes a problem. So if you have a digital services group that's embedded at the beginning of new initiatives and through existing initiatives, you can start to solution that in and use data services to make informed business decisions, connect the dots between agencies, partnering agencies, to begin to pull data together to work smarter, not harder. I mean, mm-hmm. I know all of this, we all talk about these things, right? But now how do you actually make that real?
Well, so, the other piece, if I could, is the user experience, right? Part of what the digital services team is trying to do is improve the overall user experience for those citizens of the U.S. who actually deal with the government. One big piece of that that they're focused on, I know commercial companies are focused on as well, is improving websites. And we talked, we're sort of alluding to it during the break, but there are a number of websites in the federal government that just don't pass muster when it comes to, being rendering on mobile devices and that sort of thing. We've got a long way to go. And I think partnership between what the digital services teams are doing with the agencies and the private sector is important.
You mentioned the budget piece of this, and we could apply a political lens to it, I think. And we could say this is an initiative from a Democratic president, and a Republican Congress is looking at this and saying, oh, this is a pet thing, and he's making a big deal out of this. What I think will be interesting to follow from a dynamics perspective politically is what happens if one of these Republican governors that's running becomes president in 2017. And I don't know on an individual case-by-case basis, but I know that a number of states with Republican governors have very successful digital services efforts going on, and they're really trying to apply some of the same principles that President Obama wants to apply at the federal level within their own states. And so I think maybe that's where this becomes most instructive as to what Congress's real intention is. If the fiscal 18 budget includes a whole bunch of money requested by that president, whoever he happens to be, for digital services, if the Congress is still Republican, if all of a sudden they like the idea, then maybe we see that as a potential sea change for here for
yeah,
that.
I mean,
any
I
thoughts
don't think,
about that?
I don't think this is a political issue. It certainly shouldn't be a political issue.
Because
you're right.
It makes too much sense.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. It makes too much sense. But I do think Republicans, Democrats, depending on where you sit and as those changes take place, it'll be interesting to see how it works. I think some of the cuts in funding are politically motivated, and that's part of the process as well. You see this across the board, whether it's IRS and some of the other areas where there are disagreements on policy. A lot of times you see cuts, and those unfortunately affect the IT infrastructure a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Sean?
Yeah, so I think it's important to recognize that, one, this isn't something that's going to happen overnight.
Right.
Two, This is adding a box to an org chart, right? Doesn't mean that all these problems are going to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
This is a people, process, and technology strategy that needs to be put in play to actually drive the results.
So that takes us back to your number three, which was Van Hitch's commentary. And remember his response to the question, what should CIOs do first regarding FITARA? That shift your thinking. And in this digital services environment, that's pretty important. Maybe not number one, but maybe it is number one as far as what people have to do to understand how this is going to be deployed effectively.
Well, it empowers the CIO organization to actually effectively implement digital services.
Mm-hmm. The final thought here on the digital services operation, as these stand up at every agency, is there a way that we can effectively judge from the outside what kind of impact they're having, and how long do you think it will take to establish kind of best practices where this organization will see within a government environment, this concept worked and this one didn't work as well, and so we should do more of that and less of that?
Again, that goes back to that strategy, right? Mm-hmm. You have an agency level strategy and you have an overarching strategy. How do we collect this information? How do we turn this into a performance management approach to actually see how well are we doing, right? I mean, I don't think that's been figured out. And that's why I said that's the good part about this, right? There are some opportunities for innovation in this to guide it down the direction to get those kinds of outcomes.
How do we make sure that the innovation continues to be guided in the best direction possible? Or is it better to just kind of let it happen organically and see where we wind up?
I mean, I think some of it has to happen organically. And I think some of the success we'll see and some will be more behind the scenes. But, you know, when I was talking about websites and things like that, if they're successful, all of a sudden that user experience will improve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of the measure that that we should use as we look at it, is what do we see, and then what improvements are made behind the scenes. But again, as Sean said, all goes back to strategy and empowering the CIO and all those things that we've talked a lot about over the last year.
Some of that success may be in a decrease in some of these breaches,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if you're thinking things through with the right, I'm going to say government people thinking it through, then can partner effectively with industry, then websites, digital services will be configured based on industry best practices, thinking about all of the federal risk management framework, thinking about all of the requirements to ensure we're providing secure solutions protecting federal information.
Sean Kingsbury's most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jason Miller's story on digital services. You can find a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. That's where all of our stories are archived. And when we come back, the most important federal news story of the week, as chosen by Mike Hettinger, the Federal News Countdown wraps up next on In Depth with Francis Rowe. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Sean Kingsbury and Mike Hettinger. And Mike, your choice at number one is my colleague Jason Miller's story from federalnewsradio.com, which is redesigned, by the way. And if I may brag on it, because I didn't do it, thankfully, or it would look like, you know, AOL circa 1988. Somebody would go, hey, did you do that with Front Page? Yeah, that's pretty much how it works. Julia Ziegler and our web team rebuilt federalnewsradio.com, and I think it looks pretty dang good.
I think it looks really good as well.
It's awesome.
Thank you, guys. The choice at number one, Mike, is more money for OPM cyber may not be the answer. And I think everybody's talking about OPM, cybersecurity, and so on, okay? But I think you could take out OPM and you could insert any federal agency or the federal government or whatever regarding the government in that blank. More money for blank cyber may not be the answer. I think Jason's story gets at it well here, but maybe we're thinking about this the wrong way.
No, I mean, I think that's probably right. It's a combination of things. There's, as we've talked about with some of the other issues today, there's no silver bullet, right? One person, one technology, one set of services is not going to be a silver bullet to solve all the problems. When you talk about cybersecurity, even cyber inside of it is there's many, many layers to it. It's, you know, hardening the servers, hardening the devices, making sure that that data at the document level is secure. I mean, these are all the things that we've heard talked about. So cyber is important, obviously. Strategy, you know, mission, planning, having the right people in place, all of those things, I think, go into the broader picture when you look at how we're going to, you know, more effectively lead IT in the federal government.
The story says, Sean, that the cyber ID protection solutions that OPM has procured going to cost them around $20 million. And so the gist of this is the agency may have to ask for more money, but might not be directed in the right way. And Jason writes, auditors say OPM didn't do some basic documentation, such as an OMB Exhibit 300. I'm sure you know what that is,
yep.
Which is required for major IT systems. A feasibility study to address scope and timeline, a high-level test plan. There are a number of other things that OPM's struggling with. And it's another area where I think you could take their name out and put some other agency in that's dealing with legacy systems, that's dealing with things that have been around for a long time, where a lot of people thought, well, maybe this isn't something that somebody will go after, and we're finding that's not the case.
There is no silver bullet.
Right.
It is a people, process, and technology requirement in this.
Okay? You could just write that on an index card.
That's right.
Because that fits all of the things that we've talked about so far.
Put it on my back. Right? Hey, we got some branding opportunities there.
That's right.
That's right.
But I mean, so, you know, it kind of goes back to several discussions that I would have in staff meetings where I'd say, okay, daily, weekly, monthly, let's nail that. Meaning, what is it that, you know, what are we doing daily? What are we doing weekly? What are we doing monthly? Who's accountable and who's responsible to do X? You have to have that governance, those governance processes in play, and that's what enables things like technology and tools to be effective. The governance is going to drive that. How are you holding people accountable within your agency, right? How do you come up with what you care about? Right. And then those other tools that are enablers, when you say, OK, I have IDSs and IPSs and what have you, and processes like MTIPS, right, which to me is awesome to, you know, receive security information, security as a service. Right. And now how you have FedRAMP that's connecting to FedRAMP connecting to TIC requirements, too. Right. So it's lots of opportunities to embed security. But, you know, all of these are pieces to the equation. You have to have strategy. What does this mean to us? Where are we going? What does the data mean? What happens if the data leaks out? OPM,
mm-hmm.
Right? Social security numbers of federal employees, or sensitive information. When you start to look at cases, right? You start to look at federal investigations and those types of things. You have to look at that and think about the processes that you need to have in play, because that's going to drive the types of technological tools you put in play to ensure you're protected.
I'm going to call on my Capitol Hill budget expert here, Mike. This is from the flash audit that the OPM Inspector General's office released. One area of significant concern we've identified is that OPM doesn't have a dedicated funding source for the entire project. This is their IT modernization plan. Its estimate of $93 million includes only the initial phases of the project, which covers tightening up the security controls and building a new shell environment. That $93 million estimate doesn't include the cost of migrating approximately 50 major IT systems to this new shell environment. Cost of this work is likely to be substantial. Lack of a dedicated funding source increases the risk the project will fail to meet its objectives.
Right.
Is that something, is there a remedy there that somebody in Congress can provide to OPM in addition to giving them the money that they need? Or is that something OPM has to decide on their own?
I mean, that's a tough one, right? I mean, we're talking about an initial investment and then in technology, and then you need to actually unplug and replug in and reintegrate all of the different feeder systems and everything else that go along with this. And that's always where the cost comes in. I think that's what that quote is saying. I think that was the IG that said it. It came up in one of the hearings that I was at earlier this week, and actually wrote it down because mm-hmm. I thought it was a really important point. So I'm glad you bring it up. But it's not as simple as just putting that money forward. There's a lot that goes into it. Funding, just like the systems themselves, it's very complex, and you need to figure it out. And so, and money doesn't grow on trees either. I mean, a lot of this money is going to have to come from somewhere else. There are mm-hmm. offsets that need to occur. I don't know what the supplemental request is going to look like that OPM is going to put forward, but I think they're coming forward with something early next week. The $19 to $21 million that you talked about, that's a lot of money, but most of that's just the credit monitoring services and the letters going out and all of that. So the thing that strikes me about this most importantly is the cost of doing all of these things is going to be far more than it would have been to put the right cybersecurity measures in place had we done it in a forward-thinking way. Doing it in an emergency, it's always going to cost more. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I see, and it'll be interesting to see how the funding goes. But it's always a battle, and OPM's always one that's on the line to be cut too.
Mm-hmm. That's where I wanted to go next, is that there's a money problem here, and it's not necessarily the amount of money that's spent. It's in, I guess, the priority setting. And I don't have a sense yet of whether that's coming from OPM or whether that's coming from Congress, Sean. And I guess the only way to determine that would be to go back for the last 10 years and compare the president's budget request, both President Obama and President Bush, and for OPM, and especially for their IT department, and then compare what was actually appropriated. That'd be the only way to be able to tell for sure, I guess.
It is. I mean, prioritization is always tough, right? When you look at, especially in the area of security. And the challenge is I'm going to say across the federal government, security is looked at as important from a budgeting standpoint. And there are lots of funds that go into it. And to build out, I'm going to say, good technologies and good solutions. The challenge that comes across in this article, which was very interesting, and I don't think this is only in OPM, is I'm going back to the governance pieces of this, right? Project management, doing your 300, understanding, what's my real timeline? How do I measure myself on my spend and what have you?
And I was just going to say, I mean, it really comes down to transparency, right?
That's
we
right.
want to be transparent about the full cost of what these programs are going to cost, whether it's this one or somewhere else in government. If we just say it's $93 million because we think that's all we can get funded and we're not giving the full cost of the project, we're actually at the end of the day hurting both ourselves and our agency and not giving Congress the information that it needs. So to me, it's the full cost transparency. And I was actually I was talking about this on another issue just recently. Get the full cost out there and then we can make a decision about whether we want to do it or we don't need to do it, and we actually then, if we save money, in the out years, we know how much we've really saved because we had a good baseline. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here as well.
So again, this turns into that bumper sticker again, right? Right, where you come back to
got a lot of good branding ideas. Today.
T-shirts,
hey, that's right. T-shirts, bumper stickers, but it's coming back to that digital services group, right? Because if you actually have government employees that understand technology implementation, understand, federal policy when you look at the risk management framework and those types of things, you can do a better job at coming up at estimating actual costs and come closer to being able to project from a transparency perspective the full cost of these projects.
I just did a really quick check, and the domain kingsburyswag.com is available. So you could get all your stuff on there and just direct people, put your CDs and everything on there.
You could have
there.
The music and the IT
That's
consulting
right.
on different
and
pages.
And all of that stuff, and can put it all in one place. I see a tie in this story. It may be a little obscure to, Mike, your number three story, and that is the story about Congressman Meadows getting the chair back in the GovOps subcommittee,
right.
The House Oversight Committee. The thread that I see, it comes from remarks by Republican Senator John Boozman from Arkansas on the one of the hearings this week with Ms. Archuleta and Ms. Seymour. He says, I'm very willing and very open to see what we need to be spending. After my colleague Jason Miller writes, Boozman says he's not against allocating more funding to OPM. We need to spend whatever it takes to keep us safe. The point I was trying to make was buying a bunch of stuff is not going to keep us safe necessarily. And so the reason I think there's a connection there is I hope that I see green shoots on the Republican side, where people are saying, you know what, the time for us to assume that everything the government does is bad or wrong or screwed up or goofy maybe is over. And it's not just Boozman and it's not just Meadows. We had, I can't remember the last time a Republican went and spoke at the National Treasury Employees Union's legislative conference and said employees.
I bet it was Tom Davis. But.
Okay. And employees, but he said employees deserve a raise. Jason Chaffetz did that this year.
Right.
And so it looks like there's some effort. I don't know if it's concerted yet or if it's ad hoc, but it looks like there's some effort, at least among some members in the Republican caucus, to say, you know, maybe if we really want government to run like a business, denigrating the employees is probably not the way to go about doing
it. No, I mean, that's
and your boss did that.
Right. No, and that's a really good point. I mean, and we talked about this at the opening of the show. I mean, the more you can commit to understanding that federal employees, for the most part, are there to help and dedicated public servants and choose to do this, not because it enriches them, but because it's something that they, you know, want to dedicate their life to. The more members of Congress understand that, the more important it is. I would add, I think the other thing, the other tie that I see between what Chairman Boozman said and the OPM story is, we've got to get back to a situation where we do significant oversight, right? We need to understand, not just at a budget hearing, but at the OGR level and the Senate HISCAC level, what are we spending this money on? What do we need? Where are the problems? Where are the holes that need to be plugged? You know, working with IGs, working with audit reports, all those sorts of things. There's a wealth of information in there that we need to leverage better.
We only have about 30 seconds left. You can have as many bumper stickers as you want, Sean, but we don't want it from oversight people, right? That's not constructive, is it?
That's not constructive, but there is an opportunity there to keep you honest, to make sure that you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Mike Hettinger on the Federal News Countdown. Is from my colleague Jason Miller. More money for OPM cyber may not be the answer. Gentlemen, a terrific Federal News Countdown. We should have him come back and do it again.
I think,
right?
We should. He did
That's
a good
the
job.
Problem, Sean. When you do a good job, we ask you to do it over and over again.
Anytime.
You're in the rotation now. It's great to have both of you here. And this week's Federal News Countdown is archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with all of the stories that both Mike Hettinger and Sean Kingsbury chose. Thanks very much for listening.